Good evening. It is a rare man whose past does not return to haunt him. My past is about to catch up with me on this very show. If you are interested in watching, you will be treated to a macabre succession of murders, mysteries, and crimes of passion. I freely confess my guilt. This burden of guilt I am pleased to share with you in the program which follows immediately.
Welcome to the Shamley Silhouette, yet another analysis of the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. I am your host, Zach Eastman, and this will be, ostensibly, the final time you will hear that introduction. You won't have to hear it again. You won't have to hear me say the title of a major influence in filmmaking ever again. It's done. It'll be done. We are about to record the final installment of our Hitchcock Bonanza. Unlike the show Bonanza, it went by too quickly. What started as a silly whim has expanded into something I couldn't even fathom. Within the series, we have been able to touch upon the facets of Hitchcock's legacy, career, and impact in the field of cinema. Having covered virtually every film in his career, we have been able to basically kind of jump into even the ones that nobody really talks about anymore. I and my many wonderful guests have been able to look upon the master of suspense in a variety of ways. And in the process, we've managed to have a casual discussion of Hitchcock's work that hopefully proved to be entertaining to listen to. And I'm sure Hitch would have wanted that. Always entertain the audience. Maybe play you like a fiddle a little bit. I'm hoping we did. We also managed in our own way to provide thoughtful analysis and historical discussion to the show while maintaining a laid-back nature. However, the Shamley Silhouette can never and will never top the level of education and talent behind our final guest. We are privileged to be joined by a podcaster who, through his tireless effort, has managed to explore the facets of Hitchcock and the Golden Age of Hollywood in a way that no one can or should try to match. In 2015, he produced, as part of his Secret History of Hollywood podcast, an 18-hour journey into Hitchcock's life that dives deeper into the history of Hitch than anyone could aspire to. Anybody. Don't even try it. It's not going to be done. And if it weren't for his work, the Shamley Silhouette would not even have happened, for it was a major influence into the notion that these films of the past still had stories to tell to an eager audience I once thought did not exist. Did not know you all were out there, but now I know, and it's scary. And he has gloriously agreed to help discuss Hitchcock in general and to help us sum up the master of suspense. And please welcome the host of Attaboy Clarence and The Secret History of Hollywood, Adam Roach.
Hello. My goodness gracious me. I didn't even realize you were talking about me at that point. How are you?
Yeah, well, it's true. You have an intro to your accomplishments, and they are many.
Thank you so much. That was extraordinarily generous of you.
Well, I mean, it's a pleasure to sit down with you and to talk a little bit about a subject that I'm sure at this point you are fed up with.
It's very strange. I do actually do. I write for a few magazines. And I've just been part of a new Hitchcock documentary for Paramount. And everyone at the moment just wants to talk about Hitchcock. It's almost like, you know, I thought I was finished with it 5 years ago, but obviously not.
It's a strange confluence of events.
Like, it really is.
Out here in Denver, around the time that I started the show, we suddenly had a Hitchcock series at one of our local theaters. And for an entire month, they were playing Hitchcock movies. And then they also played Charade because the connection there with, you know, how that works on a thematic level. And then Rear Window played at our Alamo Draft House, and then Psycho played at a cereal party. So I got to eat cereal and watch Psycho. Oh, so like, God. Clearly Hitchcock is not done here in this realm.
Really, really not. I don't think he ever will be. And thank God for that.
No. And we're going to talk a little bit about that and how that influence will never go away. But I wanted to get into a little bit about your history with not just Hitchcock, but the Golden Age of cinema. So you started with The Secret History of Hollywood via Attaboy Clarence. Can you talk a little bit about the origin of Attaboy Clarence and Secret History of Hollywood in general, and explain to the audience what it pretty much is in regards to how it operates as a show?
Sure. I came across old-time radio when I was about 18 years old. And yeah, I saw these faces on the front of these cassette box sets. And I thought, wow, they look interesting. And there were stories on tape, and I've always loved stories. That's going to sound like a baby, but I love stories at bedtime. So I would buy these things, and I would, you know, look forward to going to bed at like 8 p.m., and I would put these tapes on and listen to like Prisoner of Zenda and Joan Crawford in, you know, Three Lethal Words for suspense and things. And through osmosis, I think, through sleep hypnosis of a kind, I kind of developed a love for this style of storytelling, the way they scored these radio plays, the sound effects, the way they could pack 5 character arcs plus a twist into 28 minutes of these anthology series. And I just thought, I need more of them. So I spent from 18 to 25 kind of collecting as much old time radio as I could. It became much easier with the internet. So when I got to my mid-20s, I knew who these people were. I knew who John Ford was and Katharine Hepburn. And, you know, all my friends were into, you know, John Cusack films and, Tarantino and stuff. And I was kind of like, yeah, but look, all these really cool movies that no one really talks about anymore that, they're just like Tarantino. And you got these Jules Dassin films that are clearly influencing modern cinema. We should be watching this stuff as well. So I began to collect films from the 30s and 40s, and one name that kept jumping out was Hitchcock all the time. And when I first began collecting Hitchcock films, the first one I bought was The 39 Steps, I think. I thought he was a very, very different director to the way, you know, to the one I learned more about. I thought he was like an adventure director. And I also because you see his name in the credits and you see his name in articles and things, there was something about his name, I think, on a sensory level. Hitchcock, I don't know what it was, but it kind of puts you on edge. Just, I don't know why, but just his name put me on edge. And there were always films of his on late on the night. So I would stay up and watch Psycho and things. I just developed this huge love for Hitchcock. And when you see the breadth of his career from silent to sound, from TV to movies, from adventure to thriller to horror to comedy, you can't believe it's the same guy. I mean, who else can you really sort of say had that much of an effect on cinema in the 20th century? But anyway, so I developed this love for old-time radio and decided to make a podcast about, I talk about a couple of these films and then I play a radio version of it. And one of my favorite series ever was the Sherlock Holmes series with Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. I just couldn't get enough of them. I watched them on a loop, so I thought, well,
I'm glad you brought that up. Because, oh, sorry. Do we have a tech issue?
No. Are you there?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm still here.
That's cool.
Yeah, no, sorry. I'm so sorry about that. Full disclosure to the audience, I am working off of a VoIP system in order to contact our lovely guest, and my technology sucks. So I always try to make sure. No, I'm glad you brought up the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes series, because that's how I got into old-time radio when I was a kid.
Oh, my
and
God.
That's, yeah. So when your show popped up, with that episode in particular, when it was on the original podcast feed, I was fascinated to learn more of the history of those films and not just the radio show, but just like the entire facets of Rathbone and Bruce's history with that series. It was eye-opening to a lot of respects, especially near the end of Rathbone and Bruce's life and their careers.
I know. Yeah. Well, the part of the pleasure of making that episode was the fact that I didn't know anything about them, and I think that's always been my approach. I don't know everything about Hitchcock until I went and studied it for the series, but learning about these people gives you more of an urge to tell their story as you're going. It's like I didn't know much about Val Lewton. I knew he was a horror producer, but when you dig into his story is kind of like a love story, I think with the Rathbone and Bruce series, which was the first episode that I really went a bit longer on, so I'll review the 14 movies and I'll talk about the radio series and I'll talk about the guys, do a brief biography, and it turned into this 2.5-hour episode that to this day I think is the one that people will go, oh, I loved it when you did Rathbone and Bruce, because people have such a love for those movies.
it's a film series that doesn't get a lot of historical discussion mm-hmm. within context. I mean, the MPI has the there is a collection of them available on Blu-ray in nice restorations, mm-hmm. but they aren't those films kind of fell into a weird limbo, so they don't have like a studio necessarily a major studio picking them up and like fully restoring them and mm-hmm. doing a lot of commentaries outside of this one collection that's available.
I know, it's a shame. Because really, I mean, yeah. they're a great snapshot of how, you know, almost like they're almost a good snapshot of America entering the war, because, you know, you have the first two, which are, you know, set in Victorian times. And then when Universal took them over in, I think it was like 42, you know, you suddenly mm-hmm. had them fighting Nazis and dealing with intrigue on the continent and stuff. And, you know,
which is what I've always wanted.
Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want to? Yeah, well, it worked for Gatiss and Moffat as well, didn't it? Bringing it into today's
world. Yeah,
but
I mean, like, if there's a way he could team up with the Inglourious Basterds at end of this whole series, like, that would have been great. But I mean, obviously, nobody could have predicted that Quentin Tarantino would do that movie. Like, he didn't even know who he was.
Sherlock Holmes and the Dripping Scalps. Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh God. So within that, your love and your passion for old time radio and golden age Hollywood has blossomed into this whole this entire universe. And by the way, you should, if you're listening to this and you're interested in what Adam said so far, look him up on Patreon, because he provides a lot of content that's not even like the what you can access in the main feed is only the tip of the iceberg compared to what you are able to find in terms of just golden age knowledge and interactive. It's a very fun show. Attaboy Clarence is a wonderful show because you are presenting these old time radio shows to an audience that, you know, can find them through the public domain, but aren't necessarily going to actively seek them out unless they maybe, you know, have some context prior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That I think that was always the point of that show. Well, it still is, you know. It's a, I mean, so many people have reviewed things like Gone with the Wind and Casablanca and Maltese Falcon and stuff. But I'm more interested in like the B movies and the stuff that led to radio series and, you know, why some of these untold stories are so fascinating and, you know, shocking. So that's what I like to do. I like to dig into the unseen stuff. So,
and it's a testament to what you do. I mean, like you're the amount of it's funny you bring up the B movies and whatnot, because like obviously Hitchcock made his share of films that we don't discuss as a whole today, compared to say a Vertigo or a Psycho or a North by Northwest.
Mm.
But they are films that, even if they are on the lower rung, you know, they still have these interesting stories to tell. And like, and I can speak from experience that some of the B movies that are not considered amongst the huge classics are the ones that I always end up going back to the most.
Like, me too.
Bogart movies. There's Bogart movies that I love that are not discussed. Like All Through the Night is a wonderfully hilarious film, and also very terrifying at the same time.
I like The Enforcer. Have you seen that with Bogart? He plays the DA and he's trying to crack down on Murder Incorporated.
That one I haven't seen. One I recently watched though, where he does play a DA, is Marked Woman.
Okay. Yeah.
Marked Woman. It made me realize that if we had tried to make him a more straight laced hero, I don't know what that looks like down the line. It's very interesting to think like there's that final shot in the courthouse where the camera's back and it's is pushing in via a crane onto him, giving that final statement before the jury gives their verdict. And it's just like, it doesn't feel like Bogart, but that's one of the reasons why it's working for me, is because he is actually inhabiting a character and not playing off a persona per se.
Yeah, definitely. He did that a lot in the 30s, I think, before he sort of he became known for, like you say, that persona. And then every character was kind of the same hard-bitten, hard-drinking, sort of, you know, smart-aleck character. But
Here's looking at you, kid, and all that nonsense. I mean, it's a situation where that studio is trying to figure out what to do with him, and then, you know, you have somebody like John Huston going like, put him here.
Put
him over here. do I don't give a crap. You do it.
Be yourself.
Be yourself. Now get me another cigar. So I always ask the guests on Shamley Silhouette in particular, how did you get into Hitchcock? Now, you kind of already went into it, but what would be the first Hitchcock film that you can recall seeing and it having an impact?
I bought Psycho and I bought 39 Steps on the same day because I wanted some Hitchcock mm-hmm. movies, and they were like the only two in the shop, I think. So
that's right. You did mention 39 Steps, yeah.
Mm, so I think 39 Steps I watched first, and then Psycho I watched afterwards, and it was like, what? Sure, that was the same guy.
They're not by the same guy. I'm gonna confuse him. There's this one really exciting film, and then this one scares the pants off you.
It's like, you know, with 39 Steps, it's very, very... Like, you watch it now, and it's very creaky, you know, and the, you know, the effects, especially with, like, Lucy Mannheim at the beginning, where she sort of, you know, does that voiceover, and you see her face sort of superimposed over the thing, where he's reading the letter and looking at the guys in the street, and...
Yeah.
I mean, it's creaky, and I remember watching it going, really? But now, I love the creakiness of it, like, the speeded-up running across the hills in Scotland, and, you know, the auto-gyro in the sky and stuff. I love all that stuff. You got too glossy.
It's stuff, yeah, and it's stuff that doesn't. It's stuff that you see it down the line in North by Northwest. That different element. One of our guests is a huge Cary Grant fan, but he wasn't like, and he liked Hitchcock. But when I had him on for the World War II episode, where amongst things we discussed 39 Steps and how it is one of many films where he's giving a call to the warning of war. He was just like, I'd never seen the 39 Steps before, and I was amazed how much I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And he was just like, I couldn't believe I hadn't sat down and watched this.
It's crazy. Like, it's one of those films, like, you get to the end of it and you think, that was one film? I can't believe it. You know, there's the bit where, you know, the rally speech and the, you know, the handcuffing to Pamela by the fire, and the bit with Lucy Mannheim at the beginning, and the fourth bridge, and it's like one of those films. It's very much like the way I feel about Foreign Correspondent, which I think is probably my second favorite Hitchcock of all time.
I'm glad you say that.
Oh my God, I cannot get enough of that film, because it's one of the films that people say, oh, what's a good old film to begin with? And I go, right, Obsession from 1949 with Sally Gray. You need to watch that and watch Foreign Correspondent, and you won't believe how enjoyable those films are. And Foreign Correspondent is one of those things that you get phone calls halfway through. I can't believe now there's an assassin taking him to the top of a tower. Now there's they're signaling with you know, windmills, and was that Jimmy Finlayson crossing the street, you know, and with Scott Folliott. Now there's a fake kidnapping. There's a plane crash. You would get to the end of it, and it's almost like you need to go onto all fours and breathe deep for like 10 minutes straight just to get your breath back.
That plane crash is incredibly nuts for its time.
It's so well staged.
It's incredible. And I still love the story about like how he got that POV of the plane going down. He's just like, okay, I want you to recklessly dive into the ocean and then pull up at the last minute. I don't care if it scares the living pants out of you. I've grown to love George Sanders over the course of this series.
I mean,
he's great in Rebecca, but I love him in Foreign Correspondent more
because
he's just the goofy sidekick, and I friggin' love it.
Yeah.
So within that, we can dive into there's three things that I wanted to discuss in terms of a wrap up for this series. Something on the show that obviously within the show we've had to go out of order with Hitchcock and mainly focus on different aspects of his work and not go film by film by film the way you did so brilliantly on your series.
Thank you.
But the key things on it is that with Hitchcock, I feel like it's important to discuss three things to sum up his legacy on this industry. One is his origin, and his origin in film is not too dissimilar to how we, you know, people enter a business today. You start from one part of the ladder and you work your way up that ladder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he starts by moving from the Henry Lee Telegraph over to Islington Studios after he submits title cards to them. And he starts doing the title card design for Islington Studios, which was a arm of famous players Lasky in London.
And how incredible that, you know, in those days, you know, you think about the film industry these days, you need you need to have landed somehow before, you know, and then they come and find you. But in those days, it was as easy as just knocking on a door and walking in and saying, I'd like a job.
Like, hey,
but,
can I?
Yeah.
Can I make a movie?
Yeah.
sure, come on in.
But it's all, I really like love him for the fact that he was very into theater and very into, you know, true crime and things like that, and sort of thought to himself, it must have been sort of pie in the sky to ever think there would be a film arm of Hollywood ever making an, you know, a base for itself in London, you know, especially like Islington, very sort of not run down, but kind of East End-ish, you know, very sort of, you know, very common working class area. He just knocked on the door and went in, said, I'm a graphic designer for a company. Would you be interested in me having title cards for you? And, you know, to their credit, they went, what can you do? Kind of thing. And so he did these title cards and impressed them so much. I mean, there's more to it than that, obviously. But yeah, he just went in and impressed them.
And it works and it works its way up. Mm. And it, he...
Yeah.
He eventually, you know, obviously Islington drops down, but then he gets into Gainsborough and working under Michael Balkan, and that leads to The Pleasure Garden, which then leads to a film we haven't seen because it's lost, and then it leads to The Lodger. I'm still looking for The Mountain Eagle.
Oh, thank you.
Contact the British Film Institute if you find it, please.
They've got me on speed dial. They know. As soon as they find it, I'm going to update the series.
Adam, get over
yes,
here.
We got one. Yeah. Oh,
it's
my
like
God.
Ghostbusters. They just shoot a warning. Like,
yeah. They send a flare up. Yeah. Like the bat signal. But the thing is, with The Mountain Eagle, I mean, it's supposed to be a terrible film. This is the thing. It's supposed to be a bad film. It got terrible reviews. Hitchcock hated it. I do get the feeling that, you know, one day it'll be found, people will watch it and go, yeah. You know, it's such a shame. Was that it? Kind of thing. You know, and the story sounds okay. It sounds like it just okay melodrama. It certainly sounds like he made more interesting films. But
And it's clear that The Lodger is one he preferred more in terms of this is the start
of
me.
That's the first film. Yeah. So basically his history at Islington was that he went in and did title cards and was so good that they said, can you do it full time? So he quit Henley. You know, he was doing Henley in the day and then title cards at night. So he went along and did that full time and basically decided that this is the industry I want to work in. I love it so much. And every time a job came up, you know, they were walking around, we need an extra for this. We need someone to paint a backdrop. We need someone to do it. He would always put his hand up and run over and I'll do that. And in the end, it just impressed them so much that His responsibilities began to increase, and I mean, that's the way to do it, isn't it? I mean, you know, they say that hard work pays off, and certainly was in Hitchcock's case. Yeah,
I think it's definitely the same when it comes to. I mean, I went to film school, you don't go automatically. Like, I mean, you can have a focus on directing, but you start from that bottom down and you work your way up. Mm. Like, you know, I learned how to dolly grip, and it was a fun job, and then you learn different facets of what you're good at. Like, I mean, I like being an AD on set from time to time because I know how to check off those boxes and how to make sure that a set runs efficiently. Mm-hmm. And I think that as you work your way up through things, you start to understand how it works so that when you get your shot, then you are able to apply what you've learned into that scenario and also learn what works and doesn't work for you. And it clearly worked for Hitchcock because, like, even in The Pleasure Garden, from the moment he starts directing, there are moments where you can see the Hitchcock style coming through. And then when you get to The Lodger, the style is very defined. Like, okay, this is what I'm going to start doing for the remainder of my periods on this earth. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, he basically with The Lodger. And you brought this up in your series, and I thought it was very fascinating because I had no idea about this within the context of Hitchcock, is that Britain didn't really have at that time a very cemented film style, and in fact, a lot of imports from the U.S. or other countries would do way better in Britain than a British-made film would.
Absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, the British films were literally at the time just filmed plays and there was no imagination going into them. And I think, to be honest, there was kind of an arrogance among British filmmakers in that they thought this is good enough. You know, if people want the spectacles, they're coming from the States. We don't have a lot of money, so we'll just do things on the cheap. And I think they were just happy to go along like that. I think the creatives in the industry were kind of yearning to spread their wings a bit, but there just wasn't the money, there wasn't the resource. And also, I mean, people like C.M. Wolfe, who was a distributor who kind of, he was very set in his ways, very traditional, very, you know, ultra-conservative, would try to keep that creativity down in the industry himself. He, you know, he thought, well, you know, if the Americans and the Europeans want to make films that are, you know, with montage and, you know, all this newfangled film language, then that's their remit. You know, our remit is to provide something, it's more upper class. So he would actually turn films down that were more experimental, and so they wouldn't get a release. So people just stopped bothering, I think, in the end. And you know, that was until Alfred Hitchcock. And when you think of Hitchcock now, you think of him as the entertainer, and you think of him as
the personality.
Yeah, you know, Psycho. You think North by Northwest. The man actually, you know, was far more influential and responsible for developing cinema as a whole than people give him credit for. I think, you know, it's far too tempting to say he was, you know, just a name on a tin, and, you know, he could do certain things well, but, you know, people do that. You know, they say, oh, he's the Birds, or he's the guy from the TV show, he's the guy, you know, the deadpan guy. He's also one of the most influential filmmakers of all time, and helped to write the language of cinema. Certainly for Britain. I mean, you know, it's terrifying to imagine what British cinema would have been like if Alfred Hitchcock had never happened. It would have taken them decades to get to.
I mean, it'd be nothing but Monty Python.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a bad thing.
No, it's not. But we need some diversity in the situation. So.
Yeah. It's almost like his talent was so uncontainable that it just, you know, even people like C.M. Wolfe, who had all the power, were just helpless in the end. They had to agree to progress.
And it's funny you bring that up, because everybody he works for in that British system ends up kind of like, or for the most part, ends up kind of like becoming more under him at a certain point.
Yeah.
And by the time he leaves Britain for America, he is, well, one, obviously he has established the cinematic language in Britain, and not least of which for things that we still utilize today, but he's also, you know, like carrying on this legacy. And then when he goes to America and he has this abundance of resources, he's just like, look at all this shit. Like, I can do whatever I want. And, you know,
I mean, that's when it goes supernova, really. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, it's just like if you look at an early Hitchcock film from the British era, whether it's Man Who Knew Too Much, 39 Steps, even Sabotage, which I mean, I know he doesn't like that he killed the kid with the bomb, but, you know, I still like that movie a lot.
Yeah, I love that film.
It's a great film. Yeah. We had a joke on the earlier episodes of the show where he just, you know, just sits at home drinking at night lamenting the death of that fake child. So, you know, like, just going like, oh, fuck. But so he, you can see what he's able to do with virtually nothing. Mm. And then he goes to America, and then Rebecca is an interesting situation because that's a twofold, where you have Hitchcock's vision, and then you also have a guy who makes decisions. And
you could say that,
because I'm not the biggest fan of David O. Selznick, although he has unquestionably he was a man who produced some very influential classics in cinema, like King Kong. And that's it.
It was his only film. Yeah.
That's it. Intermezzo 2, and it made a great Jack Benny parody on one of his episodes, and then that was it. But then Rebecca. And, you know, we won't talk about it. There's nothing else to talk about.
Yeah, no. That was a very short career.
But he, but actually, I find that Foreign Correspondent, you know, in talking about our passion for that, that's where you get to see him really fly without even the interference of somebody like O. Selznick, which, I mean, like, you know, Selznick, it's funny, like, when you watch Rebecca, it feels like, yes, it's Selznick, but Hitchcock is clearly peering through, so it's not an over-dominant Selznick situation.
It's very, very much a Selznick film through a Hitchcock filter, like you say. It's very Hitchcockized. If that's, you know, I can use that phrase. You know, the whole Mrs. Danvers scenes, the British humor. I mean, Selznick would not have got that. You know, it would have been it would have been a very, very different film if someone else had directed it. You can definitely see Hitchcock all over it. I mean, I love the Monte Carlo stuff at the beginning. I know everyone sort of points to that being the weak part of the film. I just think that's just amazing, especially, you know, Mrs. Van Hopper stubbing out cigarettes into the face cream. You'd never have got that stuff under Selznick, you know. She's a total dinosaur walrus awful person, you know. But Hitchcock, you can tell he's just sort of rubbing his hands and going, I love this character so much. But yeah,
she we found out we loved her too out of any character, because she's like, she's not explicitly like a jerk to Joan Fontaine, but she is clearly has an opinion, and she is also like the forebearer of like things to come.
We loved
having fun with her.
Yeah, she's great. I do love her. But then again, you know, I mean, I love Mrs. Danvers even. I think she's just ice cold, and Judith Anderson, amazing. I think Rebecca is my favorite Hitchcock, only because it's that very strange jump from this is, like you say, this is what I can do now. I have all this money, all this resource. And Rebecca's one of the films that me and my wife have watched tons of times. We named our son Maxim because of that film. And, you know, I love the I love the novel. You know, it's just so good. And I think Hitchcock just nailed it as soon as he...
Yeah, and if there's one thing the audience can do is, if you got the criterion of Rebecca, to watch the special features on that, because everything that's being... discussed here is gone into greater detail on those discs, and like the Daphne du Maurier documentary that they have on it is a very fascinating piece, and getting a glimpse into the mind of the woman who wrote Rebecca, or the short story that became The Birds, or Jamaica Inn. You know, I mean, like Jamaica Inn is a film that we you know, as we discussed on this show, is there's clearly another portly gentleman interfering with the situation.
I've got to admit, I've seen it a lot. I think I've seen it, you know, I'm in double digits with Jamaica Inn, but it's one of those films I went to Jamaica Inn like 2 years ago as well, just to go and see it basically, and see what it was like. It's very like the film. You know, it's like on the moors, and it's like low roofs and stuff. And they got a Daphne du Maurier museum, and you go into that. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, I've seen it. Yeah, it's cool. They've got her original typewriter, loads of signed books and first editions and things. But anyway, so I've seen Jamaica Inn a lot more than I should have done. And I can't say that I don't enjoy it, but to me, it's like bottom rung Hitchcock, definitely. It's more like mid-tier Gainsborough, I would say. It's not nowhere near a classic in his library.
No, it's definitely a film that like I enjoy on a different merit than necessarily the Hitchcock merit.
Yeah, you
like,
don't go in looking for the invention, do you? Yeah.
I'm looking at Charles Laughton doing what he's doing and just kind of marveling at like the audacity of this hammery.
Yeah. That's exactly the phrase.
It's not egregious, say, to some other people in Golden Age Hollywood. Like, I mean, some people could ham it up really big. But it's just you are paying attention to him regardless of how that movie's operating. You are paying attention to him. That is very clear.
Yeah. It's even like when he's not saying anything, he's rolling his eyes and he's side-eyeing people and he's fiddling with his buttons and he's mincing around. It's like, oh, for goodness sake.
Don't butcher or baker me.
Yeah. Oh, for goodness sake, just let someone else have the camera for you. It's definitely a Charles Laughton film, yeah.
Yeah, and we found out in the course of it that Coen Media did at least stateside did reissue the their version of Jamaica Inn, and I managed to pick it up, and they did clean it up for how many years I had to see that film in a bootleg version on a DVD, and like it just looks fantastic by comparison to how it used to look.
Good. Well, all these films deserve to look their best, I think. I'm glad they are.
Yeah. I'm glad they're picking a lot of these up and just really giving them that fine-tooth comb. I mean, Kino Lobor out here just did Blackmail and Murder, and then they did a whole Hitchcock pack. And the one they haven't done yet is Young and Innocent, which I'm hoping they do very soon.
Oh, my goodness, I love that film. That was another film I got very early, because I was going to say early on, when I started collecting Hitchcock films, it was VHS. So you couldn't order them in. You just had to go in to this HMV, this is like our main music retailer in Britain. We used to go into HMB, and I used to look along every single case, starting at A and ending in Z, and look for the Alfred Hitchcock name. Because in those days, you know, there was no internet. I didn't really have any books or anything, so I didn't even know which films were his. So I go along, and all of a sudden, one day, I saw Young and Innocent, Alfred Hitchcock. I was like, oh, that's another one. Great. So I bought that. And it was the same with things like Notorious and Spellbound and all these Selznick films and stuff I just picked up. And I had this huge Hitchcock shelf. But I remember Young and Innocent being one that I really, really loved, because I just loved the whole blinking man gimmick and the tramp and everything.
That blinking man with that crane shot going.
Oh my
god!
Fantastic. Isn't it amazing? Oh. Yeah.
When you hear that it took a day to film that, I'm just like, yeah, I'm sure it did. Like, that's choreography on a scale that I can't imagine.
I know, that's incredible. And to end so close to his face, you know, and you just see the blinking. And takes your breath away.
It's just that twitch. It's like, because it's an elaborate shot. Yeah. And if the audience hasn't seen this movie, watch it. Mm. It's an elaborate shot that just pushes in on that drummer, and then suddenly you just start seeing him twitch, and that's the identifier that this is the killer.
It takes your breath away, doesn't it? You're like, oh my god, it's the drummer man. And they're singing about him.
I knew it.
What a twist.
So Hitchcock, he goes to America, and you know, he works his way through the 40s and establishes an American, or I wouldn't say it's American style so much, it's just that he affirms what he's learned with the vast resources that America has to offer within that respect. And then we get into this golden age period of Hitchcock where seemingly hit after hit after hit, with the exception of A Sparing Few, we hit a peak with Psycho and even The Birds, and then Marnie happens, which as we've discussed in a previous episode, has a lot of different baggage attached to it, notwithstanding the story itself. And then we have Torn Curtain, Topaz, Frenzy, and Family Plot. And in the midst of all this, specifically, he takes up Truffaut on the offer to do this interview series that becomes this very influential book to younger filmmakers. These younger filmmakers learn from it and then start making films under the changing studio system at the time, where the old guard, the people who created these studios, who founded them from the ground up, are suddenly either retiring, selling their businesses, or like Jack Warner, getting duped out of them rightly. And I mean, not rightly. It's your series on Warner Brothers was an affirmation of everything I had learned prior to that. And I love how you go through the rise and fall of Jack. It is very fascinating to hear your take on it.
Thank you.
But so basically, these studios end up getting bought up by different conglomerates and corporations who don't know how to make a movie. And so they are relying on the film school set to make their new products. And what ends up coming out of it, at least in this country, is the American New Wave, which arguably starts within the realm of Bonnie and Clyde or Easy Rider, and then ends up all the way to Raging Bull before corporatization kind of really encapsulates the industry in the 80s. And filmmakers like Hitchcock are very influential to this generation. And you can't watch Taxi Driver without thinking Hitchcock to a certain extent, not just because Bernard Herrmann does the score, but the way it's shot and the way it's executed. Mm-hmm. And filmmakers like Hitchcock are still working. But I don't know how you feel about this, but I'll share my opinion on this, is that much like Orson Welles, it's not that they couldn't pursue that. I feel like more often than not, they weren't always allowed to. And in the case of Hitchcock, I feel like there's also a bit of an attachment to his style that doesn't mesh with the things that are being groundbroken within that period. I don't know what your thoughts are on within that.
I'm sorry. Just can you expand on that a bit? When you say...
a good example would be Orson Welles' final film, The Other Side of the Wind, on Netflix, is basically a completion of a film that never really got completed. And filmmakers like Welles, who wanted to play in the sandbox with the American New Wave, weren't always given the opportunities to. Hitchcock, though, still a studio director, he was still wanted by the end. Like, The last film he would have done, The Short Night, was something they were actively working on until Hitchcock flat out said, I can't do it anymore. Mm. But outside of Frenzy, the final four films, or the final three films, which would be Torn Curtain, Topaz, and then Family Plot, they aren't within the realm of the American New Wave in terms of fully groundbreaking situations, and they feel very traditional. And one of the guests that I talked to, we felt that that was more or less kind of like a big crutch on Hitchcock at the time. Now, I like those films, but they are certainly not a De Palma film or a Scorsese film by that respect.
I think you're right. I think to be honest, though, Hitchcock spent so much of his career at the vanguard of change when it came to cinema. You know, he fully developed European sensibilities into British and Western cinema during the 20s and 30s. During the 40s, he was kind of rewriting the rules of thrillers and you know, working with huge stars who loved the fact that they were able to step outside of comic roles and romance roles to really develop into full-fledged actors, you know. And then, of course, you know, he rewrites cinema again with no budget when he makes Psycho. He becomes fated as an auteur by, you know, Bazin and Cahiers du Cinéma and Truffaut. And I think, you know, when it comes to his later career, like you say, the last few films, he was again thinking, I still have energy. Why aren't I reinventing things now? Why am I not causing more of a stir? I've done it with Psycho. I've done it as recently as just a couple of years ago. So he goes and tries to make Kaleidoscope, which of course doesn't go very well. But I think he could see the permissiveness coming into cinema. He could see, you know, there was kind of a not shock factor. I think that's like the wrong phrase, but you know, the end of the code was in sight, and you know, he was thinking, I can push the envelope now, and was told by the studio that, you know, sorry, you can't, because you're a national treasure. You're Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You're the Joker, you know. And I think that really, really, really hurt him. So he tried to, I think, push the envelope more, but actually did it less. You know, things like Topaz, which is kind of impenetrable, really. It's not a film you can think back and know what really the story was. You just remember scenes from it, you know, like the hotel where he's trying to get in to see the general, or, you know, the murder where the dress splays out. You know, you don't really think of the plot at all. It's just about something. You know, Torn Curtain, I really like. I actually really like Torn Curtain, but I don't think it's a film. It's just a film that you remember Grummet getting killed in the, you know, painful ways and very slowly. And you remember...
Which is still a brutal scene.
It's great. But and you remember the bus ride at the end where they're trying to get away, and it's very, very tense. But you don't ever think to yourself, you know, so something about a defector, you know. And I think it must have been quite painful for him, I think, to sort of be... to felt like he was on the rubbish heap at that point.
And I guess within that, when I look at something like, when I look at something like Family Plot, you know, like, I mean, and I like the film, I mean, notwithstanding my love for Bruce Dern forever till the end of time.
It's a fun film.
You know, it is. Yeah. And it's a film that I think is a testament to the humorous side of Hitchcock that doesn't always get discussed outside of the monologues for Alfred Hitchcock Presents. But we talked about it with Mr. and Mrs. Smith and The Trouble with Harry, where, you know, he has a sense of humor that he can push through. It's specifically with The Trouble with Harry, because that film is very much what if Hitchcock made a full-on comedy, and that's what you get.
Yeah.
And Family Plot runs in that similar direction. Frenzy is a situation where... you know, I think that's, you know, if we were going to get any films beyond Family Plot and he was able to, you know, keep sneaking stuff in, I think more films like Frenzy might have followed. But as you said, as that national treasure status had kind of been placed on him, it put him in a weird box.
It's very strange.
He could never fully escape.
Yeah, because he spent so long, you know, rewriting the rules, didn't realize that he'd actually spent four decades making himself this... almost, yeah, like national treasure, I guess, is the best way of putting it. You know, it's almost like, you know, I still have so much to give, and thank God he made a film like Frenzy late, because it does show that he still had the means and, you know, the devilish sense of humor, and he still had the guts, really, to do a scene like The Lovely, scene, you know, the horrible Barbara Lee Hunt rape scene. But and I don't like that scene. I find it really repellent. But
it's terrifying.
It's awful and it's just disgusting. But you know, you kind of think at the same time, good on you, you know, for being that late into your career and thinking, okay, guys, getting them around and saying we're gonna take a chance on this. You know, most people wouldn't do that. They sort of settle into, you know, Driving Miss Daisy kind of stories, but he didn't. He refused to. But also, I do think as well with Frenzy, if you look at Frenzy as kind of the bookend to his career, and you look at The Lodger as like the other bookend of his career, you know, they're both London based, both, you know, about serial killers, both have this, you know, British sensibility, very British sense of humour. It's almost like if you look at the language and the dialogue in Frenzy, it's like watching a 1930s film. Have you noticed that? It's like, you know, no character talks over each other. You know, it's very, you know, there's been another necktie murder. Oh, I heard that down the road, you know, and you get all these characters.
The exposition kind of works within that. Like they are kind of using those old techniques in a more modern fashion.
Yeah.
Like that scene in the bar where they are going over that whole gag over, you know, how murder increases the tourism industry. Yeah.
But it's just the you can see it on the page. It's almost like you can see the page before you, you know. And the whole bit with the inspector and his wife, you know, she's cooking these dinners for him, which is to this day the funniest thing I've ever seen in a movie. She's spitting out pig trotters and fish shells and things. It's like a 1930s film. So it's almost like he's pushing the envelope at, you know, the tail end of his career, but you can still see he's kind of set in his ways as well. It's a really interesting film. I'm really glad he made it. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And as I discussed it within the context of him, you know, evolving through the different phases of what we consider lurid material, which kind of goes from Lodger to Rope to Psycho to Frenzy, where it's this interesting approach to discussing human psychology. And Marnie has its own, you know, version of that. But I think Frenzy is the natural successor to something like Psycho, where you are talking about a depravity in a way that hasn't been done before. And like Psycho does it in a way that by clinically doesn't hold up today, but it still works within the context of movie language. And as does Frenzy, where Frenzy feels like it's like the last possible statement he could have made within his lifetime on that human psychology, while still maintaining, as you said, that sense of humor. That scene in the truck,
oh my god,
with the finger,
it's
so hilarious and terrifying at the same time.
I mean, can you imagine any other filmmaker trying to pull that off? He's breaking a corpse's fingers trying to get a pin out, you know, and there's potatoes flying everywhere, and you know, he's sort of picking his teeth, and it's such a great film, but you know, it's not a film I'd ever want my kids to see or anything. You know, it's kind of repellent, but
oh no!
But it's.
It took me a while to get to it. It took me a while.
It has a reputation, I think. You know, and it does live up to it. I think the whole the rape scene is just awful. But
it's terrifying, and it's not. It's a film that I think when people watch it within the context of Hitchcock's work, it is important to understand how he gets to that point.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things that contribute to that. And like, and it was, as we're discussing this terrifying scene and this disgusting, you know, visual, you know, the thing is that Hitchcock is actively trying to push that boundary. And as you said, you know, he was known for pushing, like he does it with Psycho. Like Psycho is that pushing of that boundary. It opens up a door for other people to be like, well, you know, I'm just a, you know, USC student, but I'll go ahead and make a movie with Donald Pleasence hunting down a William Shatner guy. You know, there are things that like that come off of Psycho, and in a way that like I think Frenzy, people draw from Frenzy as well. But I think like at that point in his career, he's also playing catch up in a simultaneous fashion with other people around him.
Yeah, he's being passed, I think,
and
at this point.
Exactly. And then, you know, you have something like The Short Night that is about to be that is in the works. And it would have been very much within the frame of a spy movie that he would have made in the past. But by the time that, you know, he's they're close and getting ready to go. Hitchcock's under the realization that he cannot continue to make films, like, especially on location, or just the health wise he's not up to it. And so, you know, he asks Hilton Green to tell Lou Wasserman, I can't do this anymore. And there's this big end of an era. And, you know, by the time he passes, you know, I mean, he becomes a knight and whatnot, but like his legacy is already cemented by these newer filmmakers who are not eclipsing him, but just like they are carrying on in a way that he is not able to. And what I mean, I think that ultimately, you know, had Hitchcock had gone on, the only way that I think it would have happened is, much like a John Huston, he makes films, but they'll never tap into what he accomplished early on, or even in the middle of the career, where something just innovative popped out. But Hitchcock could surprise you with something like Frenzy, so we may never know what that could have been.
It's crazy.
Well, we definitely won't. He's dead. But
it's
that's the reality.
It must have been such a painful thing for him, you know, to have come this far, and even with Frenzy, he's back in Britain. He's visiting the places that he used to know as a boy. He's making a film that's arguably about to, you know, re-shock audiences into thinking, oh my God, he can still pull it off, you know? But he's finding it hard. His arthritis is, you know, literally killing him at this point. And then Alma has her stroke while they're in London. So he's just reminded, I think, you know, come on, you need to think about stopping now. This at a time where, you know, like the permissiveness was, you know, on the decrease, and he could start pushing the envelope and start making the films that he'd been trying to make the decade before. It must have been acutely painful for him at this point.
Yeah, there's a story in the making of Family Plot that I find very poignant within the context of where he was at this point. Is they had a phone brought to the set. And as William Devane described it, is that there was a telephone in there. He answers the phone, and he put a big microphone up to his pacemaker, and to let the doctors know that it's still working. So that's already a situation where, like, okay, clearly this is the last film. I mean, obviously we know that from history, but it's just like that's a clue for anybody in that period that this is near the end, if not the end.
Yeah.
So within that, you know, Hitchcock passes away in 1980. Alma joins him not too short after. And what's interesting is that the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, Hitchcock's legacy starts getting further cemented through home video releases. And I mean, I know the way that I came into Hitchcock was primarily through those Alfred Hitchcock Masterpiece Collection ads that were on the front of VHSs by Universal in the late 90s. And the big factor of it being, like, I mean, the big selling point was, you know, a bird hitting a glass phone booth, the glass on a phone booth, and scaring the fuck out of Tippi Hedren. And you have the this is a filmmaker that then his legacy is carried on, much like other directors like a Spielberg or of that era, where like that name becomes synonymous with importance. As the years have gone on, and we talked about this at the front of the show, that the resurgence of Hitchcock, or the continued importance of him, has never really gone away. Obviously, within the last couple of years, there has been discussions of his methods and his style of directing, and, like, you know, within the context of, you know, appropriate behavior, but, and also just in terms of, like, well, what was old then? Like, what doesn't work from him today compared to what does work today? I mean, we have a great example of Hitchcock working today, and it's in the place you wouldn't expect. From my viewpoint, is A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood has a scene of pure cinema in it, with Tom Hanks telling the Matthew character that he's been hanging around with the entire movie to just sit down and just calmly think. And through silence, just pure and utter silence, and like select sound, like very faint select sound, an entire piece of this story is told within the span of a minute with no dialogue, and really following that Hitchcock sensibility, which, and those are the places that are, it doesn't seem the most obvious, but then you have people like De Palma, Scorsese, Tarantino, even up to Jordan Peele today, who are grasping onto even the bigger concepts and also those smaller concepts. If you're looking from a modern viewer, what do you think the biggest takeaway has been from Hitchcock's legacy that has been prevalent today, based on all the research you've done and just, you know, looking at it through your lens?
I would say that the thing you notice with Hitchcock, the parts that stick with you are never the spoken parts. You know, it's the imagery. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that he took a camera and a script and told a story that could be silent, like you say, at any point, you still understand what was happening. And I think today, when you see a film, I don't think, you know, people say Hitchcockian because, you know, it's a thriller or, you know, a scary kind of plot or something.
Or it's directed by Brian De Palma.
Yeah, exactly. but I think Hitchcockian really is that ability to use cinema in a way that isn't patronizing. You know, it's to use everything at your disposal to tell a story and try not to, you know, make your audience feel like a baby when you're doing it. And I think that audiences today sense it. You know, they go in to see a film, and if they're explained, if something is explained to them at length in their face, you know, and they're made to feel stupid, then they sense it. They come out and they go, oh, I didn't really enjoy that. I found it really boring. I found it really, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, no, exactly. That, yeah, and you know, and then they write a 500-page essay on Reddit, and then the whole thing blows up in the filmmaker's face. You know?
Exactly. Or it gets critically mauled, and people sometimes can't put their finger on it. I was just bored, they say. But, you know, the films that click, the films that hit these days are ones that, it wasn't necessarily Hitchcock even, you know, it was before him, it was people like Wiener and you know, Fritz Lang, and you know, people in Germany were kind of inventing it. Murnau, yeah, sorry. They were kind of inventing it. Hitchcock refined it for Western audiences, I think. But I think his biggest gift to the world was that translation of these ideas, and the fact that now filmmakers use those because they sense it's the right thing to do. You know, they sense when silence is needed, and they do, like a good filmmaker will always use imagery above, you know, explanation to tell a story. And I think that's probably Hitchcock's biggest gift to the world. The fact that he translated these lessons, put them into the conscious, and people, you know, instantly, instinctually click with them and use them to tell stories today.
Yeah, and what's interesting within that is how filmmakers who, in talking about the pure cinema of it all, which, I mean, has been a constant discussion point on this show, and and anytime you discuss Hitchcock, you talk about how silence and imagery works wonders around dialogue. What I've found interesting since doing this show and then seeing the rollout of films that have come down the pipeline through the award season or even just the general release schedule, is how even where, you know, filmmakers like Tarantino, who are very known for their dialogue and very known for that, you know, catchy banter, if you watch a Tarantino film, there is a clear amount of Hitchcockian image or like a Hitchcock feel to it in terms of how he utilizes imagery. That's it's not it, to the same effects that Hitchcock would do, but he is tapping into the imagery as well as his dialogue.
Yeah.
So there's a balance to it in a way that most filmmakers that come out of that Sundance era, you know, they write a clever script that could easily be a play, but it doesn't always work as a film. Like, I like Clerks, but it could be a play and it would be just as effective.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Definitely. It's almost like it was a lesson handed down from Hitchcock without him actually having to say it. It's almost like he showed people how to make films, and it became such a part of the conscious among filmmakers, you know. They just feel the way to make films now because of, you know, the pathway he started in the 40s and 50s. And I think if his films hadn't been such big hits, I don't know if it perhaps would have taken longer for those lessons to permeate. But thankfully they were. So, and that, yeah. And they're just, I mean, such good entertainment as well.
And they have, and they do have that influence that does feel like a call from, like, from the past, that it's inherent. Like, it's like the most basic lesson you learn even without going to a film
That's
school.
Exactly.
I mean,
it.
Like,
yeah.
The only way it's more on the nose is if the ghost of Hitchcock comes up behind you and goes boo, and then just proceeds to tell you this is how you do this.
You're supposed to be scared here. Yeah, it's like, but you know, they're like each one of his films is, you know, it's part of a bigger lesson he was teaching, wrapped up in populist entertainment. I mean, you can't get any more sort of more instructive than that, can you?
No, and within that populist entertainment value, I mean, we've talked about Hitchcock as like a guy who wants to entertain the audience first and foremost, and like, favorite quote, play them like a fiddle. You know, escapist entertainment of a North by Northwest nature, a 39 Steps nature, even has a big impact on what we see in the industry today. I mean, in terms of the biggest releases down the theatrical schedule, it is escapist entertainment. As to whether or not it falls in line exactly with the cinematic ideals of Hitchcock is up for consistent debate. But I mean, the biggest way that I've seen it permeate through in terms of breaking those grounds is through the horror genre, which obviously is a testament to Psycho and The Birds being as influential as they've been. But I think that, you know, we see a lot of influence on from Hitchcock on things like modern spy movies like Bourne Identity and it's not the best example, but Red Sparrow with Jennifer Lawrence was clearly had Hitchcock in mind when they were making it. Like, it's very, very obvious and on the nose, but that's still entertaining and fair to that filmmaker to give that approach. So
yeah, definitely. One of the moments I think of now when I think of Hitchcock as well in modern cinema was in Joker, you know, when he he stabs his, you know, his co-worker to death in the apartment.
Oh god, that scene.
You know, you watch it, you go, oh my god, there's that moment of shock, and then, you know, the small guy goes over to the door and can't reach, and it's just like you burst out laughing. It's all done without dialogue, you know. It's one of those moments in the films where you just think, god, Hitchcock would have loved this.
Yeah, oh, he would have adored it. When I first saw Joker, my immediate callback was to something like Henry, A Portrait of a Serial Killer. But like, hearing that, no, that's absolutely true. Like, that scene plays out, and it is played out in a very quick edit, not unlike a montage that he would have done. And just the humor that lies within that terror is very much him. It is a
because you don't
straight
know
up.
For one moment if he's going to kill him too. So you're on edge. You're like,
oh, I thought he was going to kill him.
Yeah. And you're sitting on one.
I was just
one
like, he's
ass
lost his mind.
You're as tense as a nut, and then all of a sudden you burst into laughter. That's pure Hitchcock.
it's mainly the fear on his friend's face where you're just like, man, like, I just, and Phillips, it what's interesting is that, like, he, you know, he's playing it in a weird humor that, like, he's always done, and this was just like the dramatic logical step to take it in, because like, if you look at something like a Hangover, he's clearly creating a cinematic approach to comedy, and then this, he applies a Hitchcockian method to this bizarre scene that just works so wonderfully within that film. And then, like, within all of that, Hitchcock, you know, his directing style and the way, like, I would say that, like, amongst the things that didn't fully translate, or, like, I mean, I guess it's a case by case basis, but, you know, the one thing that has been discussed at length on Hitchcock is, you know, his feelings towards method actors and, oh, well, actors in general, but you know, but the working with people like Montgomery Clift or even Paul Newman, where you know, he's trying to tell them from what he's learned and what has worked for him, that, like, my frame is your guideline. You step out of that frame, then I'm not getting you, and that's a problem. So whatever you do in that frame is up to you. Whereas I feel like, you know, the camera has been lifted off the tripod, so to speak, and is allowed to move more freely. So in a sense, I feel like not only have acting methods changed, but also the way we carry on those things. So it's almost like, you know, keeping something within the frame, as long as if you're going to move it around like that, you know, it's clear that, like, people saw something like that and, like, okay, I like this part of it, but let me apply my own thing to it. So it's almost like a lot of his ideas have evolved into stuff that we see more often than not today.
Yeah.
I feel like, I mean, John Carpenter obviously is influenced heavily by Hitchcock and Howard Hawks and John Ford. And I think Halloween is a great example of how he's not even taking off of Psycho per se. He's taking off of like different things that Hitchcock liked to do, and just applying them to this small, you know, siege on a small suburban neighborhood in Illinois slash Beverly or slash California. So, you know, like, so it's very clear that people look at what he does and then adapt it. And like, as recently as Us by Jordan Peele, where you have a horror film set in the Bay Area and playing off of that imagery, like locations are a big thing. Like people like establishing a location as a character in and of itself, which Hitchcock clearly loved to do with things like Vertigo, where the city itself becomes a bit of a character. And so that within all that, the legacy of Hitchcock, it's a ghost that keeps haunting this industry in the best possible ways. And I don't think we're ever going to be done with him. As you said, like, I mean, if there's one thing I've learned from your show is that these lessons that the beginnings of this industry have to teach, have no reason to ever go away, because they'll always be eternally relevant to the discussion.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, thank you, first of all. But yeah, I don't think there's any reason they should go away either. You know, I don't think you should ever sort of, you know, put a stamp on the past and mail it away. You know, it's always going to be a part of film history. And it's great that people are still acknowledging it. And especially for people like Hitchcock. I mean, there's never going to be a time when he's not relevant, which is kind of a gift for the world, because it just means more and more people are going to watch his films eventually.
Right. And then they'll get as excited as we get over Foreign Correspondent, be like, George Sanders should have been the best friend in most more movies, not just the villain.
Yeah. I love the fact that, you know, people can watch like Foreign Correspondent and you know, even things like Notorious and Spellbound and all these films just from early 40s stuff and go, God, that felt modern. There's a reason for that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that they feel modern, it's that modern films feel like Hitchcock films. So, and there's, they always will.
I'll tell you let me ask you this. This is a question I didn't think to ask when I was preparing everything, but when you were doing the Hitchcock series, did you have a chance to see Hitchcock movies in a theater, like different screenings going on where you got to see audience reaction to them in a modern context?
No, unfortunately not. There's not really that much outside of London in Britain for the classic film lover. So, I mean, you can journey into London and see those kinds of films, but they're few and far between. But I am lucky enough to own a projector, so I do get to watch them on the big screen. In fact, I got a PlayStation VR thing a couple of years ago, and it has like a cinema mode. So you put it on and you put a film on and it feels like you're in a cinema, and you can actually look around at this huge, huge screen in front of you. And the first film I got to try it out with was The 39 Steps. It's like, it's such a great film to watch on the big screen. So, but yeah, so in answer, I haven't done it with an audience, but I've done it many times alone.
Now that just makes me think of Hitchcock doing VR now. That would have been.
My God.
Oh my God. We could put them right in the Bates Motel. Alma, we could put them right there.
I'm behind you.
It's all
you.
There. Yeah. Like, what I found interesting since I started the show was, I mean, like, and we talked about how convenient it was that suddenly Hitchcock was playing all over the place. Like, one of the screenings I got to go to was Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which is as obscure for Hitchcock as you can get.
Yeah.
Because if you look at that film, you're just like a poster for it. Unless you're reading the name Alfred Hitchcock, you're just like, oh, it's a Carol Lombard schoolboy comedy. Yeah. Okay.
What do you think of that film?
Nothing to do with the man. Yeah. And I love that film. I think it's a delight.
Do you? Okay. I get really annoyed by it.
So here's always been my eternal thing on it. It is certainly not the best screwball comedy in the world. Mm. However, anytime I can watch Carol Lombard do something, I am entranced.
Me too.
I think it's a very big attestment to her ability as an actress. I mean, and I've been upfront on the podcast, you know, like, I mean, one of my favorite films of all time is her final film. And I mean, there's multiple reasons for that. One of them being a suave, debonair comedian, but something like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, what I find interesting is that, like, I don't enjoy it on the same level as, say, I do a My Man Godfrey or The Awful Truth. Mm. What I find fascinating on it is just like, wow, this is decent work from a guy who wrote Princess O'Rourke and has the screwball queen herself and is directed by somebody who I'm not expecting to do this. So there's a certain level of me where I'm just like, man, I really appreciate what's going on here. Like, is it as exciting as, say, other screwball comedies? No, but I'm getting a kick out of it. And when I saw it with an audience, they were roaring with
laughter. Really?
I mean, okay, like, even in places that I wasn't, and I'd seen the film multiple times, and I was like, you know, okay, I know the beats here. They're roaring with laughter, and I think a lot of them didn't even know that this existed for Hitchcock.
Okay, that's interesting. And I get more annoyed by the plot. I think it's very well directed. Like opening scene, you know, where they've had the argument and they're sort of like, you know, avoiding each other, and he hides behind the sofa, and then you see their feet playing under the table. I mean, I think it's a very well directed film. I just I think it's the plot I have problems with. It's just like, you know, about 15 minutes into there, you know, separation, I just think, oh, just get back together, would you, for goodness sakes, you know.
They draw that out, that's a bomb under the table that I wish would just go off immediately.
It's like, oh god, you were so clear. All you've got to do is like explain something to each other and you'll be back together, and then the best friend comes into it and stuff. So I get quite annoyed by it, but then I do have fond memories of it. I do think it's very well directed, and like you say, anything with Carol Lombard is you know, a treasure to be treasured.
and her relationship with Hitchcock, and as you discussed in the series, you know, it adds a double impact to that film in its existence, not necessarily for the story itself as we were just talking about, but like just the fact that like this is the only time she ever got to work with Hitchcock, and imagining how that could have, if she had not passed, how that might have, like, how she might have done more with him.
Oh my god, that'd be amazing.
Which I would have been fascinated to see her in, even if it was in a thriller, because Lombard gets the comedy label, but she was an actress through and through. Like, she could do anything.
I find it like quite fascinating to imagine her in any kind of 50s cinema or late 40s cinema. You know, what would she have looked like as an older woman? And, you know, what kind of roles would, you know, obviously she'd still be beautiful, but I really wish you got a chance to see her, you know, in the you know, the second or third part of her life. You know, I think she would have been equally as important.
I think hands down she would have been a part of the cast of It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World, because they found a way to get everybody in there. But...
yeah, definitely. Oh my goodness, yeah.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, like, but the in terms of like the reception of an audience to Hitchcock films, like the big ones, like we saw North by Northwest in a theater as on the regular show I do, you know, my friend, being the biggest Cary Grant fan that can possibly exist out here in the States, he was enamored and transpired. He brought his wife along, and the audience's just reaction to things, like, it wasn't just laughter in the funny moments, it was gasps, it was genuine surprise, because not everybody had seen it. And what was fascinating to just watch, like, it's almost like I've seen that film so many times, I can shut my eyes and just listen to how everybody else is responding, and that is the more interesting element of this whole screening.
Okay.
Rear Window had this very same effect. Everybody was very digging into Rear Window. I think before we wrap up, you know, I have loved talking with you about this, and I know that you have obviously been able to discuss Hitchcock in a way that the most people don't get to outside of Donald Spoto or Stephen Rebella. What would you say, even removed from the series that you did itself, you know, how do you see Hitchcock after all this is done, after having that much time with the master of suspense himself, and then having it removed with time with a person like Val Lewton or even a Jack Warner? Like, how does it stand out to you?
Well, you know, I lived with Hitchcock for, I think it was 18 months the whole series took me, and I remember getting to the end of writing it and releasing it, and I actually felt very, very bereft. You know, I think the more you look into him as a person, I'm not talking about his film career now, but as a person, I just found him very, very human and almost, you know, someone I could relate to. And part of my reason for making that series was that I'm so tired of him being presented as, you know, a monster or, a film director, mm-hmm. even, you know, or just as, you know, the guy from the beginning of Alfred Hitchcock Presents or a buffoon or someone who put his name to books or, you know, or something like that. I just got really tired of the fact that people are so easily pigeonholed these days. So when I got to the end of that mm-hmm. series, I kind of think that if I had any kind of success with that, it was that, you know, I kind of portrayed him more as a human being, that, you know, and there was mm-hmm. there's no one thing or the other, you know, he was lots of things. He was a show off. Right. He was, he definitely had,
prankster.
Yeah, exactly. He was a prankster. He was, an utter genius. He had issues when mm-hmm. it came to women. You know, he was a loving father. He adored his wife. He knew when to quit. There are so many things when it comes to Alfred Hitchcock. Yeah. And I think when I got to the end of his life story and I looked at the whole thing and I, you know, began with a small boy above a green grocer's shop and ended with a man who completely changed cultural entertainment in the 20th century and will be forever remembered, it just demonstrated to me that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, you can have an effect on the world. And Hitchcock, for me, was like when I said goodbye to him, it was like, I've said goodbye to a family member. And I do think of him now as that. I don't think of him as, you know, this, you know, a mysterious figure from the past. I think of him as someone I got to know really, really well. So I do miss him. I miss all my subjects.
Well, thankfully, obviously, you discussed that you've been able to talk about this subject even more with the documentary, but also the amount of additional stuff that you do within Attaboy Clarence and Secret History of Hollywood on the Patreon, like film clubs. You know, there's always that opportunity to go back to this subject.
That's great.
And I'll say that, you know, this is a figure that I grew up with in the oddest of ways. I didn't start with a John Carpenter or a Toby Hooper like most people did. I started the way those guys ended up starting, with films like that, and then grew into those later things. So with Hitchcock, you know, there's obviously been discussions of, like, as you said, the monster element, but also, you know, the character from the TV show. And what I've appreciated about sitting down with him as a subject for is that you can address those things, as you did as well in the series that you did, but not lose a respect for the man and also, you know, find an adoration towards it. Like, I'll tell you, my favorite thing that I've been able to do over the course of nearly a year is to, you know, put curse words into Hitchcock's mouth and make him a person. You know, like, when every time I do that imitation, it's the worst imitation of Hitchcock imaginable.
But I know who you are. Yeah.
You know, we've had so much fun with that. And I like doing it with Jimmy Stewart too. Like, I haven't made an appearance yet. I'm going to come on one last time.
Very good.
To talk to, hi, Adam. Hi, I'm Jimmy.
Hi, Shock.
Oh my God, I went even
tired. So it's one of those things that I think has been fascinating throughout the whole thing is that, you know, and especially from modern context, you know, like, you know, I've certainly had a reckoning of my own. Like, as you've listened to the series, I've had to come to terms with different facets of Hitchcock while still maintaining the ability to continue on to the show and still, you know, by the time this is over, I'm still going to pop in Psycho every year. I'm still going to be watching stuff like North by Northwest and A Rear Window, you know, and it's amazing how that ghost that we discussed not too far back in the conversation has lingered all these years, you know, amidst anything that the industry has been changing and evolving into, and amidst anything that has been, you know, discussed in terms of his legacy and how that is both relevant and irrelevant or whatever the case may be for anybody, that he's still there. The bottom line is he's still there, regardless of where the argument lies. And I'm eternally fascinated by that. And, like, I've looked at Hitchcock from this respect as just, like, it's almost like being able to be put in the position of a Truffaut, where you are basically learning at his feet. I'm not in front of him, but I've got all this information coming at me. He feels like a real person in a way that he hadn't before, which is eternally fascinating in that respect. Because, like, and as you just said, that you went through the same thing, where it's not just this industrious figure that like we put on a statue or, you know, on a mural. Like it's a human being that lived and breathed. And
yeah,
and the same goes for Alma Revel.
Yeah, oh my god, yeah, she's incredible.
Alma Revel, talk about a woman who, if there's any precedent for things like the Be Natural, the Alice Guy Blaché documentary about how we don't talk enough about, you know, the legacy of women filmmakers and whatnot. But Alma Revel is one who, you know, the contribution that she made has been very, very openly pointed out by Hitchcock himself. Mm. Like what I love about Hitchcock is that he never discounted his wife's
impact. Never. And he constantly tried to remind the world of just how much of an impact she had through his films. And you know, he might've been the name as a director, but she was equally as responsible for everything he made. Definitely.
And it's one of those reasons why, like, you know, when I first saw the Hitchcock movie that Sacha Gyarvasi did, I was a fan of it, and my opinions on it have like evolved differently. But one thing remains the same is that that's a movie that gives Alma Revel a voice that she never had before.
Yeah, it gives her props. We need to give her more credit. Definitely, that's one of the points I made a lot during the documentary we just made. It was just that, you know, Hitchcock is so important, definitely, but he really was a team. He didn't work alone. And when he knew that Alma couldn't work either, that's when he stopped too, so which should tell you everything, really.
Yeah, and I think that's a love story within that, you know, like, I mean, and, you know, like, I think that within her legacy, what's interesting is that we do have a lot more information on her than you'd think. And it's something that I think deserves a wider discussion, much like you have been able to provide through your show. Because I think one of the beauties of your show is not just the fact that you're talking about Hitchcock, but you talk about a variety of people that have an involvement in his career that have sometimes even bigger parts to play than Hitchcock in certain situations. And Alma is certainly one of them.
Yeah, 100%.
I do feel that by the time I was done with your series, the amount of patience and devotion that Alma had while having the consistent dedication to her craft is something that is a wonderful lesson to how we don't look deep enough into figures in history and how that, you know, needs to shift.
Thank you. I couldn't think of a better compliment. Thank you. That's very nice.
I mean what I say on this when I say that, you know, one of the things that you've been able to do with this is to help provide a gateway for people in a way that I think that, like, not even this show can do. Like, when it's all said and done, we're kind of doing a bit of a riff on things while still, you know, providing those facts. But, like, you've done the work of creating, like, it's an audio film to a certain respect where you are crafting stories. You are actively creating a world for people to fill in their heads, not unlike old time radio.
That's very kind. You know, that's extraordinarily kind.
Whereas I am trying to apparently be Mark Maron, and I don't. and who are your guys, Adam? Who are your guys? But, you know, thank you very much, Adam, for capping off this silly experiment that's going to continue into a different form or fashion. But really quickly, I want to let you plug anything you've got coming up. And I know you've got a big thing coming up, it should be already released by the time that this has come out. But you have another Secret History of Hollywood subject.
Yeah, I've made 8 series now. I think Hitchcock was number 4. I've also done Audrey Hepburn, the Warner Brothers. I've just finished Val Lewton. That was a big one. That took 2.5 years to do that one. I've done Universal Horror, and I've done Basil Rathbone, and I've done Pre-Code Cinema, and I've done Hollywood Communism. And the next one is Cary Grant, which ties in very nicely to the conversation we've just had. Thank you. Oh, it's turning into a bit of a behemoth, I have to say. It's very, 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 very long. And I actually, last month, decided upon an idea that I should really have injected from the beginning. So I've just started to rewrite the entire thing again. But it's working out really well. I'm very pleased.
Our first guest, Ryan, is going to go nuts over it. He's finally going to listen to the show.
Wow, thank you.
I'll anytime, like, My friends like the fact that I like Golden Age Hollywood, I'm just like, go listen to this. Like, don't listen to me. Like,
thank you.
And this one I think is going to be a great way for him to dive, because he likes, one of the things he's loved, he went through all of Grant's films and did his own ranking.
Right.
And,
okay. What did he come out with? Number one. I'm intrigued.
Awful Truth. It stuck with him as his favorite, and it's just really came down to, for him, was the formation of the Grant persona and how that is fully formed within that, and also the production of that film, I think, utterly fascinated him, and he loves Irene Dunne. Mm. So there was a lot of factors within that. But like, amongst the ones we've actively talked about, we went to go see The Bishop's Wife in a theater at Christmas time, and we just had a blast.
Well, we watched that for film club, I think, at Christmas, just gone, me and the patrons. And surprisingly, one of those films I've seen dozens of times, and it still made everyone laugh. Everyone was so into it and bemoaning the fact that it was, over when it was finished.
It's
great movie.
It's amazing because you get to watch Cary Grant essentially be an X-Men. I know he's an angel, but he's really an X-Men.
That is the best description ever.
Stopping short of Patrick Stewart coming in and going like, would you like to join my school? Like, there's he's just helping out these people with his awesome angel powers.
With his wine, with his sherry powers. Refilling glasses.
This is why we do it, is so we can just be like, what happens if, Hitchcock, decides to make a Jason Voorhees movie? How does that happen? Which I would have loved. I'm not going to lie.
I hope your friend likes the Cary Grant series. The first few series I did were very documentary style. They were very, it was just trivia, really. And life stories kind of thing. But with Hitchcock, I think I took a bit more of a biopic-y kind of turn. By the end of it, it was very much a life drama. And then the one I did after that was Warner Brothers, and that was basically just like Game of Thrones in Hollywood. It's very, you had dialogue between characters. And the last series I did, which was Shadows and the Val Lewton story, that was, I kind of don't exist in that. It was more the characters telling the story themselves.
Yeah.
I think with this one, with Cary Grant, I've tried to, I have. the style has changed again, I think for the better, because there's something that happens. I can't go into it too much, but it's very big, bold storytelling. I'm very, very proud of the way it's going, and very, very proud of the way it's told, which is the only hint I can really give you, but it's definitely different.
I insist that you do not tell your friends how the Cary Grant series ends.
That was the worst Cary Grant I've ever heard.
I know. Was supposed to be Hitch giving that warning.
I'm joking.
Okay. Yeah. So psych. No, that I'll tell you. That goes back to the ultimate thing about that. That showmanship, we talk about digging deeper. When it's all said and done, though, the audacity to tell people, don't tell the ending of my movie. You created spoiler alerts.
You did. God, the guy had so much reach, didn't he?
the amount that he did. And also, I would encourage people who have heard what this Grant series is going to be and getting teased a little bit by it. You really owe it to yourself to go to Adam's Patreon and sign up for it, because you get access to everything, and the amount of content he puts out and the depth and detail he goes into is staggering and incredible. And there is the film club where you can participate in watching the movies that are discussed.
Thank you.
And get insight from not just him, but other people who are within that Patreon sphere.
Thank you. It's a really good fun night every month. Yeah.
Yeah,
I love it. Thank you.
So that's pretty much it. This is the end of Hitchcock at this point. Now I still have a couple episodes to record because I'm pre-recording, but
I'm raising a glass to you now, and congratulations on finishing your series.
Thank you very much.
I know how it feels when you get to the end of a big project like this, and it's emotional, and you must feel very, very proud of yourself, and I'm so glad to have been here at the end. Thank you.
I'll tell you, the big thing that I'm taking away from this is, one, obviously talking to you, but two is that, when it's all said and done, these are figures that I thought never had a voice to say anything anymore, and that I thought I was like the only person in this sphere who was into this stuff. And then as you grow older and you realize that the world is much bigger and brighter than you realize, there are other people who have these same interests, and to discuss it with them. Like, I mean, it's not Hitchcock, but like, I didn't think there were other Jack Benny fans in the world. And then all of a sudden I find that there are like more than I would care to know. So like, you know, but yeah, this series has been a fascinating dissection into a childhood icon of, you know, what it means to be afraid. You know, the Universal monsters, you know, first ones to scare me. And then when I saw the shower scene in Psycho, I was scared shitless. So, and I saw that when I was 10. So like, clearly, you know, like there are still reactions to be gotten from these stories. So thank you again, Adam, no for coming on board to wrap this up. This is going to be the final episode of The Shamley Silhouette. If you're looking for the back episodes of The Shamley Silhouette, look at realnerdspodcast.com. On the next series, I don't know yet. I still have to make decisions, tough life decisions. But this has been The Shamley Silhouette.
Until next time, when we shall return with another story, good night.